Let's do it.
To the right, 5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches
look at
it.
This.
To Mo Williams! Touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
Welcome back to another episode of the Climb in the Pocket podcast. I am your host, Jason Brown, joined once again by the full crew. QB1, JR, what's going on, my man?
Going good, man. Sitting here watching this home run derby right now. My man Aaron Judge is in a bit of a hole, down 22-0 home runs right now. So we'll see if we can get out of it.
Is it bad that until I saw your tweet this evening that I had absolutely no idea the home run derby was happening, baseball all-star game was going on? I guess the folks I follow on Twitter just don't really do baseball at all.
Yeah, this is kind of a sports dead period for me. You know, I'm a big basketball and football guy, but I follow baseball kind of casually. If the Yankees aren't playing on TV, I can't really watch it. And the only reason I'm watching this is because Judge and Gary Sanchez are in it. So that's the only reason I know about it.
Okay. And the Yankees, it's a perfect segue for Miles. You know, Biracial Angel is the name of his fantasy team, Mr. Derek Jeter. Oh, Miles, what's cracking with you, man?
Oh, you know, count down the days. What is it? 5 more days till my wedding?
I'm gonna need you to know how many days.
So it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 5 days.
All right. Well, I hope you got all your stuff together. Make sure you keep a slight bend in your knee when you're up there. We don't want you passing out, going viral or anything like that.
Too late. It's going to happen.
And last but certainly not least, Nicodemus. What's going on, my man?
How you doing, y'all? It's a good day. I had my first saxophone lesson in probably like a year and some change, and it was good to – you know, it was good to just start from the bottom and, you know, just kind of work on all the things that I need to work on and just get behind, have a teacher behind you, you know, just kind of yelling at you, telling you how awful you are, but how much potential you do have. It was a treat. And speaking of treats, I have a question for y'all. What is your, I'm always eating something on the podcast, whether it be candy or some sugar good, popsicles, all that stuff. So my question is, what is you guys' candy of choice? Mine would have to be Skittles, or really anything fruity, but definitely Skittles. Wildberry, because we all know the wildberry is the best kind of Skittles that there is.
Anything fruity.
I was going to say, I swear, JR judges you every podcast, bro.
He says anything fruity.
There were 20 episodes in, and every week, JR just sitting there quietly shaking his head. Well, since, you know, JR, what about you, man? You go in for the sweets?
See, I'm not a big sweets guy, but I kind of have a weakness for Skittles and Starburst. It's kind of a tie for me. I'm not a big chocolate guy. I'd rather eat the hard candy, so I'm more of a Starburst Skittles guy. Those are pretty much the same for me.
All right, how about you, Miles?
I like Skittles. Skittles probably one of my top. I'm a big – I like gummy stuff, like the Lifesaver gummies and all that. I really like that stuff.
All right. And me, I go with the sour stuff. So probably the Sour Patch Kids for me is what I'm getting if we go to the movies or something like that. Sour Patch Kids or the Sour Skittles is probably what I roll with. So
you ever eaten the Sour Patch Kids watermelon things?
Yes.
No, I have not.
No. I'll send you some. Tell me how much the postage is to Canada, and I'll send it to you, man.
All right, man. We'll figure that out. Before we move into the next part of the pod, I did want to give a shout-out to the listeners. Our listens have been slowly creeping up, so I wanted to say thank you to everyone who's tuned in, listening to all these episodes we're putting out for you guys usually twice a week. We're on our job and getting these out for you, so thank you for everyone who's listening. And for those of you who are listening and enjoying what you're listening to, slide on over to iTunes, hit us with that five-star rating, and hit us with a review if you can. We'd very much appreciate it. But you know, it is a dead part in the sports calendar, as JR said. Not too much going on. A little bit of NBA stuff here and there, but we've done a lot of that talk in the last couple of weeks, so we're going to bring it back to the Vikings. And JR didn't post a poll. He just basically posed a question today about if you were picking right now, who would be the three Vikings team captains? So last year, the team captains were Griffin, Rudolph, and Robinson. And so JR posed the question, got some answers. JR, what did you learn? Who are the Vikings fans out there clamoring to be the captain for this year?
You know, the answers were really all over the place, not surprisingly, because in my opinion, offensively, I don't think they have a lot of natural-born leaders. Defensively, I think that's where most of the team's clear identified outspoken guys are. You know, we had the Sam Bradford debate on Twitter. I think it's a very debatable topic. Me personally, I don't think he should be a team captain just because he just got here. And I know a lot of people say the team captain, the quarterback should always be the team captain, which I don't think is always necessarily true. It's just situation dependent. But a lot of people named Brian Robinson and Everson Griffin. Those seem to be the top two names. But offensively, I just don't see any clear defined leaders right now, in my opinion. So I'm interested to see or hear you guys' opinion on this as far as who you guys think should be the three leaders. For me personally, I'll just go ahead and jump right into it. My three guys are all on defense. I think the first one is Harrison Smith. The second one is Brian Robinson. And my third one is Everson Griffin. Those would be my top three guys.
All right. Yanka, we'll go to you next, give you a chance to defend yourself from the comment section on Daily Norseman.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But I would have to go. I do somewhat agree with JR where there isn't a very somewhat of a clear leader on the offense, but I'm still going to go with one guy. But my very first captain would be Everson Griffin. I think he's obviously the emotional leader. He's the more of the vocal leader. You see him obviously breaking down the huddle quite often. He's the guy that's going to – I mean, he's matured so much, and that's why I think that he's what I wanted to see my captain. You know, a guy who, you know, kind of came into the Vikings as a knucklehead, but, you know, grew into his leadership role. The second guy I think I put on defense, I would probably put Brian Robinson as well. You know, he might not get as much snap time, but I think that he still is – such an important piece of the Vikings, whether, I mean, not necessarily just off the field, but obviously on the field, but also off the field. And then I actually, I'm going to throw in a wild card. Not a lot of people are talking about this. But I think I'm actually going to say Stephon Diggs as kind of an emerging leader that you're starting to see. He's from the minute that he walked in, you know, he was great with the media. He was great with the fans. You know, when you see teammates getting hurt or you know, anything to the team, he's kind of one of the first guys that are up there voicing his opinion and making sure that he, you know, he defends the team and stuff. So I actually have Stephon Diggs as one of the captains on the offensive side.
So Yinka, I think we have a problem now because the diva of the crew, I think he signed a contract that said that, you know, he would get first dibs on any wide receivers that could potentially be in consideration. So while you were there talking, Miles, he was saying some things that were less than flattering. So Miles, did you have any potential captains that weren't wide receivers, since it looks like Yinka stole one of your choices?
That was gonna be my sleeper. Like the way they're trying to make, I'm not saying he's the face of the franchise or anything, but they're kind of parading Diggs around like he's like that the offensive the show. He's the face of the at least the offense right now. But I do if I'll stay away from Diggs then. I think Bradford's going to get captain. I'm not saying he deserves it, but I think it'll happen. I don't know if he deserves it. I'm not there every day. And I'd say the other two guys would be Everson Griffin, and it'd be a toss-up between a Kyle Rudolph, Brian Robinson, or I think another sleeper could be Eric Kendricks too. I think he's coming into his own. He commands the defense anyways. And then Harrison, but I'm having a hard time because of B-Rob. It's all about how they view B-Rob still. I know he's still a leader. He's gotten the captain position the last couple of years. So it's a toss-up for me. Right now, though, I'll go with Bradford, Griffin and Smith with some guys like Eric Kendricks, and then it wouldn't surprise me if B-Rob got it again.
All right, and for me, I think I go with Harrison Smith, Everson Griffin, and then I'm also on that Diggs train as well. I think that all the points Inger brought up there that, you know, he had to learn to rein it in a little bit when he first got here, where he was a little wild. It would go and kind of pop off if something happened on the field. But over time, and just the way it seems that he's matured a little bit, I think that he would be a good person in that role on the offensive side of the ball. And we have to have the conversation, since, you know, Miles did mention it, JR mentioned it as well, where it's, you know, very often we see that the quarterback is put into that role as captain. But I guess I think of the captain as someone who is, you know, a leader on the team. And I don't think it's a slight or a dig or a knock to say that that role isn't one that seems to come naturally for Sam Bradford. JR shared a video today from the quarterback's coach, and the quarterback's coach had an opportunity to really say, you know, what he saw as Sam's strengths and all the things that he saw Sam being very good at. And they really echo what you've heard about Sam his entire career. He's very smart. He's a professional. He picks things up really quickly. But one of the things he made a point of saying is that Sam is his own kind of guy. He's not the guy that's going to go get in someone's face. He's not the guy that's going to go and, you know, pull someone up and you know, tell them when they made a mistake or whatever it might be, or get in someone's face or try to hype somebody up. Said he's just not that guy, that he's, you know, kind of go lead by example kind of person, but he's not that vocal leader. And I don't think that it's, you know, a knock on Sam to say that. I guess, JR, I know that you were mentioning kind of some of the back and forth that happened on Twitter when this question came up. I guess, what are your thoughts on that? And is it an issue if the quarterback isn't your team captain?
In my opinion, I think it is. Just because the thing about being a leader is that it's either you got it or you don't. It's not something you can develop. And I know Kevin Stefanski was talking. He was touching really good on this as far as Sam having a lot of great qualities as far as picking up the offense, being good with the guys off the field. But when things get tough, you just can't see Sam Bradford getting in a guy's face like a Drew Brees does or a Tom Brady does. And it's just a respect thing. And my thing is, I have no problem with a guy being a quiet leader. But the thing about being a quiet leader is that you have to perform. Your performance has to show if you're a quiet leader. And I just don't see Sam doing that right now. He's been very inconsistent in his career. He had an outlier season last year. It was a good season. I want to see him do it again. But in order to be a quiet leader, your performance has to be very good. And I just don't see any guys in the NFL that's a quiet leader and their performance not show that can be a team captain. That's just my opinion. So I'm not saying Bradford's leadership is wrong, but I just think his performance has to step up if he wants to be a quiet leader and a team captain. That's just my opinion.
What about Marcus Mariota?
That's different. His performance does it.
Yep, I'm with JR on that one in terms of the performance piece. Yinka, how about you? What are your thoughts on this whole leadership conversation? And, you know, we know how you feel about quarterbacks in general and how they're given too many accolades, too much praise. So are you with JR on this one, that the leader has to be or should be that quarterback? Or do you think that can come from just anyone else on the offense?
You guys know how I feel about this. I don't feel like the leader has to be the quarterback. But like JR said, I do think if you're not going to necessarily be the leader in that quarterback position, you know, your performance kind of has to shine through a little bit more so. I think we look at someone like Aaron Rodgers, who, in my opinion, he's not a leader, you know. But week in and week out, we see him perform, which obviously helps players to gravitate towards him. And I think the Green Bay Packer team would be a little bit different and less cohesive if Rodgers has, you know, 6 to 8 games like right in a row where he's not performing at the Aaron Rodgers we know. So that's why I personally don't feel like the quarterback has to be the team leader, only because, you know, sometimes I want guys on, you know, other positions to kind of step up and be that leader, you know, guy on the offensive line to, you know, really get the unit working as a whole. You know, maybe a guy like Harrison Smith in the backfield, making sure guys are lined up the way that they should be and making the right, you know, calls that they have to have.
Should your leader, your captain be your best player?
Harrison Smith is a great example of a quiet leader. You rarely hear Harrison say anything on game day, but his performance speaks for it and it makes up for it. That's a great example. Defensively.
Yeah. I would agree. No, I don't feel like a captain has to be your best player. And I actually remember having this conversation in high school with one of my friends, and she was on the basketball team. And, you know, we were talking about, the, you know, the captains are getting picked and stuff. And, you know, we were going back and forth because this one player wasn't really that great, but she was chosen as a leader, as a captain. And I remember her very specifically saying, like, hey, captain doesn't have to be your best player, which is true, because I think sometimes the best players, you know, that comes along with, you know, sometimes you'll see an ego that's there. Sometimes you see not being able to handle pressure as much with their talent. Whereas I think a leader is a lot more consistent and solid through and throughout, regardless of whether they're playing at their highest peak volume or even if they are the best player. I think the leadership is able to more effectively bring out the talents of the people that are around them versus the best player who, you know, they perform really well, but they might not necessarily force other players to play really well.
Okay, so what you're saying is that Odell Beckham probably shouldn't be a team captain for the Giants is what I'm hearing right now.
Probably receivers, not. Receivers are rarely be team captains.
Miles, you going to stand up for your people, or are we going to move on?
I know, no. Well, can I get my two cents in?
Yeah, man.
No. Well, I mean, they're outlying examples of guys like Larry Fitzgerald. Obviously, he's a, you know, one of the better leaders for the Arizona Cardinals in their franchise's history. So that's a, again, though, one of those rare examples. You know, guys like Calvin Johnson, Andre Johnson, some of those guys that they didn't do a lot of talking, but they're those quiet leaders. Those are some of those good examples that that JR was talking about before. Personally, though, I think with the quarterback position, I think it's important for them to be a leader just because it comes with the territory. That's the position most people talk about. It's the most important position on the team. So it kind of comes with the territory, whether a guy's ready for it, whether they're good at it or not. I kind of think they're thrust into it. So – And I really don't think Sam Bradford, from what I've seen, I don't think he's like a terrible captain. I don't think he's a guy like, I think it kind of gets overblown in a sense in the NFL. Like, yes, those guys are important and they're the leaders of your team. But at the same time, it's not the end all be all if a guy's a captain and another guy isn't, or vice versa. So, if a guy like Sam Bradford gets captain and they vote him captain, I think a lot of it is because of the position he plays. The role he's expected to be in that on that team, he's expected to be a leader, whether he wants to be or not, whether he's vocal about it or not. So I feel like that position in itself is just kind of, you're like thrust into that position whether you like it or not because of the position you play.
Yep, that makes sense. We're gonna slide into another conversation where today we were having, you know, some back and forth, a little discussion about, you know, the random things we talk about in the group message. And Yinka, full of inspiration, I guess maybe coming from sax practice, took the conversation, and in a matter of what seemed like moments, Yinka had an article that he pulled together and got up on Daily Norseman. So Yinka, tell us a little bit about the article that you put together, the creative process that got it done for you so quickly, and what you were trying to drive home with the message of your article about verbiage in the NFL.
Yeah. It was ration from our conversation that we had. I know that you guys have some really great points that I try to tie into, but mostly the overarching theme was about NFL verbiage and how, you know, we're kind of seeing it become a thing that's actually hindering the development of a lot of players, specifically at the quarterback position. I kind of cited a few guys, Johnny Manziel, Marcus Mariota, who really they didn't have that. You know, they didn't have the NFL verbiage or even the pro style verbiage in college. All they did was, you know, they rarely operate out of the huddle. They had some hand signals on the sidelines, and then they, you know, they ran the play. You know, which obviously speaks to, you know, they had the ability to the talent to be able to perform at those levels. But obviously, that transition was a little bit harder for some versus others. I think Marcus Mariota is starting to step into more of a leader, and he's able to handle the pressure. Whereas someone like Johnny Manziel, you know, for various reasons, but I mean, one of them was NFL verbiage and not being able to use that to his advantage, as well as, you know, maybe he didn't have the mental acumen to be able to handle it. But I guess I was more or less tying it to my own personal journey as far as being a musician and understanding that, you know, I was actually going to leave to a saxophone lesson before, and just before that's when I wrote the article. And I kind of likened it to how young students in music have to start with, you know, a level of simplicity with their playing. And even with that level of simplicity, some of the techniques that they're learning, you can see them very obviously in most music, even today. You know, you oftentimes hear music is really only four chords, 1, 5, 6, and 4. But I kind of liken it to, I think we would see, more players being developed at an appropriate pace. If, you know, maybe we take away the complexity of just the verbiage, not necessarily the complexity of the offenses. You want to still keep that complex, but I think it'd be easier for people to, you know, just like learn a language. You start off, you learn more what you can say, and you don't really focus on the things you can't say in the when you're learning a language. And then once you obviously transition to, you know, more sophisticated language, and then you start learning more of the rules and the things that, yeah, maybe you can't say as much anymore. So that, I mean, that's mostly what the article kind of gets into, and I'm curious what you guys' thoughts are on the conversation.
So yeah, JR is someone who obviously has had to to call plays out, you know, command a huddle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because what are your thoughts on that? You know, often we get things thrown around like your pro style offense, or, you know, never had to call plays when they're coming in. Like, what are the big adjustments that a quarterback needs to make coming from most of the college schemes into the NFL? And is it as big a deal as we think it is?
From a player standpoint, it is a big deal because it's something you've never done before, especially guys playing mostly in a spread up-tempo offense now in colleges. Nobody is calling out an entire play. Everything is signal-based, and most quarterbacks are doing is all they're doing is telling the offensive line the protection. And the receivers have a certain signaler from the sideline that they're looking at. So the quarterback is never telling them anything. And it's a lot more on his plate in the NFL. We talked about it this morning in our group chat, how a lot of coaches are saying this my way or the highway with the system, as opposed to adjusting to their quarterback and what's best for them. So just an example play call that I was looking up earlier from John Gruden. One of his plays was flip right, double X jet, 36 counter naked, waggle 7X quarter. Imagine him saying that to you, and you got to repeat it in a huddle, and it's something you've never done before. So it's a big adjustment, as opposed to just saying a formation and the protection to the offensive line, which is all they're doing in the spread offense. So it is a bit of an adjustment, and I don't think it's an overblown issue from a fan standpoint, but from a coach's standpoint, I think it's a big adjustment that a lot of coaches need to make, but it's just something that they won't do, just because if they had success in their system, like I said earlier, they're going to think it's my way or the highway. So take a guy like for Jared Goff, for example. Me and Miles talked about this earlier on All or Nothing, how Rob Borst's play calls were just way too long for Goff, and he just had troubles comprehending it. And you see it in the episode. I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but one of his first passes in the game was he called the play completely wrong. He went under center. He was supposed to be in the shotgun. And little stuff like that matters, because a lot of passing concepts in the NFL are timing-based, and especially a guy like that where the game is moving extremely fast for him in his first start. So it's a big deal, but I think coaches need to adjust, but it'll never happen just because it's just how coaches are.
JR, I don't think you need to worry about spoiling for the listeners the fact that Jared Goff was not good. I feel like most of the listeners of this show probably have watched some NFL at some point over the last year or so, and are aware that Jared Goff was arguably the worst quarterback in all of the NFL. So I don't think you'll be getting too much hate mail for spoiling that for anybody.
They made him seem like the best practice player ever.
Miles, how about you, man? What are your thoughts on this whole play calling? You know, as a former receiver who had to, you know, absorb that play that the quarterback's giving you there. You know, how is that in terms of the complicated system, simple system, and does that affect how you play when you're out there?
Yeah, so when I was in college, it was a spread system, so we did all the signals through the sidelines. So we didn't huddle. So it'd definitely be a different transition going into, you know, the NFL and huddling up and having to do that. But at the same time, I mean, we did variations of it in high school, but I don't really consider that much, you know, all that complicated, because they were simple routes, simple concepts. But the higher level you get, I think, you know, some of that verbiage and the understanding is tough, because, you know, especially as a young guy at the receiver position, you're trying to remember the one thing that you know you need to do. But so you hear that, you know, within that verbiage, you hear the one thing that you know that relates to you. But, you know, being able to grasp the whole understanding of that specific play, you know, having to do that with 50 or 60 other plays, it's a tough thing to do. I think I think the huddle system is kind of overrated in that sense, that guys having to speak in a huddle. I don't think it's that big of a deal, depending on the, like what JR is saying, though. It all depends on the verbiage. It all depends on what you have to tell the whole team. If it's really something complicated, that's a big difference then, you know, if it's just something like two right jet, X sweep, and that's all it is. You know, something simple, something easy, doesn't take much to get out, and it's easy to grasp. I think a lot of that is, it plays a big factor in the huddle, because I think most guys can sit there and talk in a huddle, and that's not the thing that would worry me as a coach. It's the verbiage and what he's trying to get out to tell the team. So it's all about understanding. It's all about you know, dumbing it down if you need to for some guys. I mean, you'll see a lot of players. I think early on, Brett Favre really struggled with that kind of stuff early in his career. And you'll see some coaches for some young guys, they'll give them the wristbands to kind of go with the play call, so that, you know, if they hear part of it, at least they can look at their wristband and say, okay, here's the rest of that, of what the coach said. I might have missed part of it, but at least I have some help here to kind of help learn and grasp everything, because it moves so quickly, everything goes so fast. So being able to kind of see it on your wristband, like, and have that confidence that you know what the specific play is, it's a big deal. But like what JR said, I just watched that All or Nothing episode with Jared Goff, and is the first one supposed to be in the gun, and he goes under center, and he completed the pass, luckily, though, but it could have been a bad play because of it. So it's a tough situation. I think coaches really need to do a little bit of a better job, in my opinion, to help young players adjust to that. And some coaches do, but I think some coaches just really don't, and they're so stubborn that they don't want to do it. So I think there's got to be a little of that meet in the middle type.
And you both have kind of made the comment that you don't really see NFL coaches being willing to change on that. And I guess, you know, we'll go to JR first and then give Yinka the last word on this, since it is his topic. I guess, why don't we think coaches are more open to changing, given that, you know, such a big part of a coach's job is teaching? And I mean, there's been a lot, even if you go to USA Football right now, there's an article up there about, you know, simplifying the play calls, using word association to make it easier for your guys to just kind of figure it out and go and play faster. And given that, you know, there seems to be, I say, research done that shows that, you know, guys can play quicker if you simplify your play calls, why do you think that, you know, these coaches continue with these play calls that are so long and so complicated and so difficult for people to learn?
I think it's a combination of players' upbringing and, like Miles said earlier, coaches' stubbornness. And, you know, I love using North Turner as an example. Great offensive mind in the 90s with the Cowboys. But his system kind of got outdated as time went along. With the Chargers, it kind of was at its peak with Phillip Rivers, LaDainian Tomlinson, and Antonio Gates and all those guys. But the game has evolved now, and play calling has gotten a lot shorter as far as, you know, a certain tempo of formation and a certain play. With the whole play, it's kind of a package now, as opposed to singling out every single person on the play is doing. So let's say there's a 2x2 set, meaning there's two receivers on each side of the formation. In North Turner's plays, he tells each and every receiver what they have on the play, as opposed to just saying one word. Let's just say the play is, just say something simple, poker right, Stanford. Stanford means the whole entire play call, as opposed to telling the X, A, Y, and Z receiver exactly what they're doing. So simple stuff like that helps guys out. Just combining the whole play into one code word instead of just telling each and every person what they have. And it helps the quarterback out as well, because he doesn't have to say as much in the huddle.
That's exactly it. Real quick, too, just to jump on that. In college, that's exactly what we did. You know, like a, you have the personnel you need. That's what I'm going for. You know the personnel, so you're running out there. They say two right, let's say Missouri. That was like a play call we had in college. You know exactly what position you're at. You know what you need to run on that. So everybody knows from that one word what they need to do. It's really easy. It's really simple.
Awesome. And Yinka, final words to you. Now, please defend yourself from the Daily Norseman comment section. I went in there and read. Your article seemed pretty straightforward, but it seemed to get some folks a little upset with you there. So I guess maybe they missed a point a little bit, or maybe they didn't fully get where you were going with it. But give us a synopsis and yeah, deal with the comment section. Let them know that it's okay to stand down.
Yeah, I did comb through the comment section, and I think there's kind of a misunderstanding as far as, you know, I did mention Sam Bradford mostly because I wanted to make it somewhat relevant to Vikings. If I mentioned North Turner, Pat Shermer, Sam Bradford, really any Vikings, I think it wouldn't have served our community very much or how it's relevant to us and how we can start looking at it. And I think it was obviously misunderstood, like, hey, I don't think Sam Bradford is too bright, so he can't understand NFL verbiage. And it's more or less trying to say, like, I know that people don't think of this as a job, but I mean, it is a job for a lot of these players. I mean, and just like at your job, place of work, you know, if your boss or corporate throws basically everything at you and expects you to swim, I mean, more people, more often than not, they're going to sink. I mean, they're going to drown because, you know, our mental capacity of human beings can only allow us to retain so much information as well as obtain. So, I mean, as far as Sam Bradford, what you saw in the beginning of the year is you saw him have a simplified game plan. You saw him have some probably simplified verbiage as well. And you saw him thrive. Now, again, as the season goes on, you want to see, just like teachers, you want to see them start to introduce a lot more complex comments, right? Those scales that I kind of mentioned, you know, those beginning scales that you learn, you want to see those start to evolve into, you know, more advanced pieces and more technical skills and stuff. And that's where I was more or less going to with the article. You know, so it wasn't bashing Sam Bradford at all, but, you know, there is a semblance of relevancy I always try to bring, you know, something that's a great conversation like NFL verbiage and try to bring it back to how is this relevant to the Vikings and how is it going to help us in the future with not just the quarterback position, but also, I mean, like, guy like Laquan Treadwell, who, you know, he might struggle with verbiage, or even, you know, former Viking Cordarrelle Patterson, he probably struggled with NFL verbiage, and that probably contributed to him not being able to be the player that we wanted him to be. So that was majority of my point, is trying to bring it relevant to us and our family.
Awesome. Well, speaking of, you know, good conversation, things that are relevant to the Vikings, we're gonna move it along. Talk about the tight end position. Yeah, we're going to get right into here, and we're going to knock one person out of the conversation. Nobody can pick Rob Gronkowski as their number one tight end in the league. I think that would be a unanimous selection from all of us. So, JR, I'm going to start with you first. Who is your favorite tight end in the league not named Gronk?
My favorite tight end to watch in the NFL is Jordan Reed from the Washington Redskins. I mean,
really?
He's just
if you consider really, him tight end.
Really?
Yeah. Let me finish.
Your favorite tight end in the league is the one dude that has the same name as you?
Let me finish.
Okay.
The most complete tight end in the NFL is Travis Kelce, in my opinion. Just because he's a guy that can be in line and block, be a tenacious blocker, or he can flex out, and he can be a dominant receiver as well. That's why I like Travis Kelce.
You mean besides Gronk, though?
I mean, we said besides Gronk, though, right?
Yeah, besides Gronk.
Yeah, Travis Kelce, the most complete tight end, besides Gronk.
You just really wanted to throw in there that my favorite player in the NFL is Jordan Reed.
I mean, he stole my name. He stole my name, so I had to mention him because it's such a great name. It's spelled a little different, though, so he didn't completely steal it.
It is a good name. Miles, how about you? I mean, you know, the tight ends do sometimes take a little bit of shine from you, steal some of your targets, but, you know, who is your guy not named Gronk? Because I think you at one point said Gronk might be the greatest tight end of all time.
I still believe that. I really do. If we're taking any people in their primes, I would take Gronkowski over any tight end. And that's really hard because I think Tony Gonzalez is – it'd be a toss-up between those two. Anyways, I'm taking Greg Olsen personally. He's a three straight 1,000-yard seasons. He's a really good inline blocker. And the guy just knows how to get open and make plays. He's been a baller since he's been to Carolina. And I think he's a Hall of Famer at this point in his career. I think he's on his way to being a Hall of Famer. Really good player. So that's who I'm going with. I'm going with Greg Olsen. Really fun to watch.
All right, Prince, how about yourself, man?
Dang, I was going to pick Greg Olsen. I love watching his game. I think he's definitely been a kind of a security blanket for Cam Newton since he's been around. But I guess maybe to change the conversation, let's go with the ultimate dad runner and Jason Witten. Now, I don't necessarily think he's like the greatest tight end in the league right now, but I think obviously with you, what you see as far as leadership skills and longevity of career, and how kind of consistent he's been for the Dallas Cowboys, he would definitely get into my top five as far as tight ends. So I'm gonna switch it up, and I'm gonna go with Jason Witten.
I really want to boo that selection, but I won't. Y'all know how I feel about the dad runners, but you know it's your selection.
I know how you feel about the dad runners.
So I'm gonna let you have it, but
at least Jason Witten's gonna be a Hall of Famer though. So
but should he be?
Yeah.
Why?
Absolutely.
Yes.
His career? He's been absolutely. So legit his whole career.
See, I guess, and this is, I mean, we're going off on a tangent here. Maybe it might need its own thing. I'm not really about Hall of Fame being about dude who just kind of was there for a really, really long time. Like, I can't think about a point in my life watching football where I was like, if I was starting a team today, Jason Witten is the guy. Like, he has caught a lot of passes and been around for a long time and been super consistent. But there's never been a time where I was thinking about football where I was like, Jason Witten is that dude at tight end. It just hasn't been.
He's overshadowed by Tony Gonzalez, Antonio Gates.
Those guys.
But that doesn't make him a not Hall of Famer.
I'm just saying those type of guys are a guy that if you are a defensive coordinator, you're terrified about playing those guys. And those, when I think of Hall of Fame, those are the type of players that I think about. The guys, the Randy Mosses, the guys who come in and you're like, oh my God, like, what are we going to do? The players who are about excellence. The guys who make the Hall of Fame just because they played for a really, 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 really long time, that's just not what the Hall of Fame is for me. And so
that's not why I think Jason Witten's a Hall of Famer. That's not because he played a long time. It's because he put up great numbers early.
He played a long time.
No, I'm talking like if you look at his stats, I'm looking at his stats right now. He had in a 6-year span, it would have been 6 straight years of 1,000 yards, but the only difference that broke him up was one season was 942 yards, and another season was 952 yards. So, but otherwise, it was 1,039, 1,002, 1,030, 1,145. I mean, the guy had 6 straight seasons of almost 1,000 yards as a tight end.
So, Miles, do you consider Kyle Rudolph a Hall of Famer?
No, because that man just literally had a career year, and he didn't do anything special.
But what I'm saying is Jason Witten's yards per reception for his career are almost identical to Kyle Rudolph's for his career. So that's what I'm saying. Like, he's a guy who caught a lot of passes, but I don't see him as a guy who's taken over a game. He just caught a lot of passes and played for a really long time. Like 10.9 yards per carry, I mean yards per reception at the tight end position is not impressive. It's just not.
I need y'all to jump in because we got to get this man because Jason Witten's a Hall of Famer, like straight up.
I think
that's that Cowboys propaganda machine that I got you on right there.
No, here's what I'll say, Jason, is I think that the conversation of taking over a game, quote unquote, is, you know, that is an important skill to have and whatnot. And yeah, you might say that we might not be necessarily game planning to stop Jason Witten, but I think that's kind of what speaks to his greatness is because offensive coordinator or defensive coordinators weren't planning for him. I mean, you could probably see in some of those games that those are the games that he actually showed up. If you don't account for Jason Witten, and I'm not just saying take him away necessarily, but if you don't account for him, he will start showing up in games, and that's where you see some of his career numbers start to spike. I mean, to have consistently a tight end, there are very few tight ends that we can count in the league that have had consecutive years of 1,000 yards reception.
Hey, like I said, I'm not taking away from the fact that he's been very consistent. I'm just saying that for me, when I think of Hall of Famer, one of the things in my head in terms of what I'm thinking of is, you know, in a given year, did I ever consider that person to be the most dominant player at their position? And Jason Witten just was never that when I was thinking about NFL tight ends. But I mean, this conversation, even though it is tangential, it does bring us to the next kind of thing that we had on the show sheet, which when you guys are looking and evaluating kind of tight ends in the NFL, what traits, what are you looking at that you consider to be the most important thing? I feel like Miles is going to say consistency. But yeah, we'll go with Miles first since I did just kind of call him out there. What are we looking at when we talk tight ends? What are you thinking? What are you seeing as the most important traits for that position?
I like a guy who's versatile. I don't like the just one-trick ponies, the guys that are just good at one or the other. I like guys that can do both because, to me, you maximize the people's potential and their abilities if they can, especially at the tight end position, if they can do both, because you don't have to take them off the field in certain situations. You can always keep them on the field. So the guys like the Jason Wittens, the Antonio Gates, the Tony Gonzalez, well, Antonio Gates early in his career wasn't the greatest blocker, but he got to be at the point where he could do it on a decent level. And then the Rob Gronkowski's of the world. All those guys are guys that you didn't have to take them off the field at any point in any scenario. So that's where I'm like, if I don't have to take a guy off the field, you know, especially as an inline blocker, and he can handle his man one-on-one and still route up a safety or a linebacker, that's a guy for me. Like you had just talked about Jason Witten's yards per reception was 10.9. Tony Gonzalez's career was 11.4. So it's not like it was like that much more ridiculous. But then you see a guy like Gronkowski, who was at, I know he's missed a lot of games and everything, but he's at 15. His career yards per reception is at 15. Then you got Antonio Gates, who's at 12.5. So I'm a guy, but I don't want to get off, you know, too off on a tangent here, but I'm a consistency guy, like you said, but at the same time, I like a guy who's versatile. I like a guy who can do a little bit of both.
How about you, JR?
I think it's versatility. I want a guy that can be an inline blocker, a guy that can flex out in any type of formation, put him on the outside, put him on the inside. I don't want to have to be able to take you off the field if it's a running down just because they know you're not a threat to block, or we can't run to your side just because you're such a bad blocker. So versatility is the biggest thing for me. I don't want to have to be able to take you off the field no matter what the situation is.
Okay. Prince.
Yeah, I think I mean, I do really love versatility, but I think as far as my tight ends, what I like to see, I do like to see kind of a above average trait, regardless of what it is. Maybe you are and in this league, obviously, pass catching is really important for tight ends. So I am looking at a tight end that can kind of be like a basketball player, more or less, is, you know, make them tight window catches as well as being able to create space for himself with his size and whatnot. So that's where I'm looking at, where I know that we love versatility, but I'm more so on the side of like, I want him to do, you know, the thing that we're kind of asking him to do the best. So, you know, I can get multiple guys who can do multiple things, but I'm definitely looking at, you know, as far as tight end, maybe I'm looking for an elite type pass catcher or just like a basketball player who I can count on in the red zone. So that's kind of my trait that I look at.
I think I'm there with Prince on this one. So I did recently drop an article. Actually, it was today, about why Bucky Hodges is the key to supercharging the Vikings offense. And what I did when I was researching for that article is I looked at the last 10 years of draft classes, so going back to 2007, and looking at all the tight ends drafted since then and kind of what traits that we can measure most correlated to being successful. And so what I found from that, it kind of aligns a bit with what Yinka is saying, is that size-adjusted athleticism, so height-adjusted speed score, was really the thing when you're looking at the top guys drafted since 2007 in terms of targets, receptions, yards, touchdowns, yards per game. That was the thing that correlated most strongly, and that kind of aligns with what I would be looking for. And when we think of the guys like, you know, a Tony Gonzalez, an Antonio Gates, a Greg Olsen, Jimmy Graham, like Gronk, obviously, those guys are huge, but they're also athletic, and they can create those mismatches for you when they're going down the seam on a linebacker, or they can go up over top a defensive back and make those type of plays for you. And that's really what I'm looking for. And then the next thing that I found there was, you know, explosiveness. So a guy who can go up and get it for you. So I know we've had conversations a couple of times, you know, talking wide receivers and having that wide receiver who can go up and get it for you in the red zone. But what I found over the last couple of seasons is that, you know, the most efficient plays in the red zone was throwing it to your tight end, probably because they get more favorable matchups when you get down to the red zone, or going to a smaller slot type receiver. Those guys converted touchdowns most efficiently. So again, looking for a guy who can go up and get the ball. And then the last thing that I found when I was doing the research was a guy who produced in the passing game in college, or someone who is more likely to produce for you in the passing game when you get to the NFL. So for me, I know that, you know, blocking, and that's typically been the thing that's kept tight ends off the field when they make that transition. And obviously it's a skill that they need to learn, but yeah, I'm going to go for, you know, the big athletic dude who produced in the passing game, because what I'm looking to do building my offense is trying to score points first and foremost. So, and the last point I wanted to make is that, you know, Yinka brought it up. Can't remember how many recordings ago it was or how many articles ago. Yink has written so many recently. But talking about us, you know, going to more two tight end sets offensively, and I think he was highlighting it in the red zone. But the other thing that I found when I was researching my article was actually adding tight ends to the formation made the passing game more efficient. And targeting tight ends on first down, second down, third down, or fourth down was always more efficient than targeting a wide receiver or a running back. So adding tight ends was actually a better look for you than, you know, adding, say, a slow SEC wide receiver who only had one catch in his rookie season or something like that. You'd probably be better off adding, you know, an actual tight end instead of someone who runs like a tight end to the
15 yards per reception. Just saying, 15 yards per reception.
So with me throwing those not so subtle shots at Miles, I guess said a lot there. Is what are your thoughts on, you know, obviously the athleticism piece from a tight end perspective, but then also kind of transition from that into the idea that, you know, offenses might be better off going to tight ends more often because it does allow the versatility, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll start with Prince, since you were the first one, I think, to put this thought into an article, and then we'll just go Miles and JR to round this out.
I'm definitely more for the two tight end sets, and this is why I kind of wanted us to get a more athletic tight end, I think. As much as I love Kyle Rudolph, his athleticism isn't quite what I want for my number one tight end. You know, I kind of want my number one tight end to be a little bit more of an athletic freak, more like the Bucky Hodges mold. And I think when you get to the red zone and where you get into, you know, tighter spaces where you need your guys to maybe win those one-on-one matches a lot more so than being able to scheme them into place. That's why I was looking more for some of those two tight end sets and whatnot. And you know, as much as I love Stephon Diggs, you know, I had to take him off because I wanted more of that, not just athleticism, but I wanted the guys that I felt like could win more so in the red zone. And that's something that Stephon Diggs struggles with. But
we were getting along so well this episode. We were getting along so well, Yinka, and you just had to go and mess it up.
You know how much I love Stephon Diggs. He's one of my captains, man. I love Stephon Diggs. But I think just seeing something different is what is going to help the Vikings be able to take a step forward. We don't see a lot of two tight end sets unless it's a run play. And we saw that a lot last year. You know, in the year before, Adrian Peterson was constantly in the two tight end sets, you know, out of the dot, you know, between the tackles. And we didn't obviously see enough of the hard play action fake off of the two tight end sets. And finding a guy like Kyle Rudolph on the seams or having Bucky Hodges be able to catch the ball this year. So that's something that I think will transform this offense to be a little bit more versatile with seeing two and even three tight end sets. So, yeah, I'm definitely an advocate for it.
Miles, you're ready. Seems like you have some things to say there about my comments about, you know, us being better off putting, you know, one Bucky Hodges in there to improve the offense based on his athleticism, college production profile versus one Laquon Treadwell going more three wide. What are your thoughts on what we're saying here in terms of, you know, the numbers maybe saying that more tight ends is better than more wide receivers?
Hater. No, I don't mind the idea of getting Bucky Hodges out there and more two tight end sets because he's in this offense, if he's used correctly, he shouldn't be really considered a tight end. He'll be more of like an H-back, in my opinion. He's a guy that you move around. He might line up in the backfield. He might line up offset, you know, behind the tight end. And a guy that you move around, I'd say kind of in a Rhett Ellison way, but in a more of like a more athletic way. Because they moved Rhett Ellison all around and made him do a lot of different things. But that was mainly to help in protection and for blocking. In the run game, but I think you could do that with Bucky and create mismatches in different scenarios by lining him up all over the field. So I like that idea. And if it has to take, you know, you take out a guy to do it, I mean, Treadwell would probably be the first guy off the field, and because you keep the two wide receiver set, so it'd be Thielen and Diggs. you bring a Bucky, and I'm okay with it. But early on, how much are we going to see it? We haven't seen this man. And once we see him in pads and see, I would like to see some sort of ability to block. I mean, even if it's just a little bit, but I like the idea of getting him in mismatches and allowing him to kind of work against slower linebackers and smaller safeties. So I like it.
All right. And Miles brought up the one knock on my man, Bucky Hodges, which was the blocking. And I think the quote was, Bucky Hodges' route running makes my eyes, was it hurt or eyes bleed, JR?
Hurt.
Okay, yeah. So what are your thoughts on A, Bucky Hodges getting on the field early, and B, the idea that maybe more tight ends is the way to go from an offensive standpoint?
I'm fine with, you know, the double tight end sets, but I would rather Kyle Rudolph be the attached tight end and, you know, just move Bucky all over the field. And, you know, in the red zone, I envision something like Bucky actually being on the outside or in the slot like he was at Virginia Tech. So let's say Bucky is on the outside, Diggs in the slot, Rudolph is attached, and you take your choice at Thielen and Treadwell on the other opposite outside receiver and take your choice in the backfield as well. So a formation like that I would really like to see as a red zone package. And I think Bucky can be an ultimate tool in the offense, but it's up to Shermer and how he can use him as a chess piece. And I think he can be a big mismatch. And, you know, Virginia Tech did a really good job of that. He had something like 20-something touchdowns, and a lot of them were jump balls. And that's what he specializes in. He was a red zone monster. And I think that's a role he can be for the Vikings as a rookie.
Awesome. But just to follow up on that for you, JR, because none of us obviously, well, maybe not so obviously, but none of us mentioned Kyle Rudolph in our kind of top tight ends in the NFL. You know, we've kind of mentioned his name at a couple different points here, but where do you rank Kyle Rudolph? Like, where do you see him in terms of kind of where he stacks up in the NFL at the tight end position?
I'd say he's top 12. You know, I don't have a complete list of guys in front of me, but there's a lot of guys that immediately pop into my head. You know, the Gronks, the Kelseys, Jordan Reeds, Greg Olsons, guys of that sort. So I think he would be in that top 12 range just because, like I always tell you guys, he's a catch tackle guy as opposed to those guys that are a threat once they have the ball in their hands. And that's just something Kyle Rudolph doesn't give you. And that's why I can't put him in that top tier.
All right, Miles, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think too many people, when they start ranking offensive players, they go to the fantasy football route. So you have to be, you know, you have to put up fantasy numbers to be good. But I do think a guy like Kyle Rudolph is in that 10 to 12 range. I think, you know, you obviously have the Gronks, the Greg Olsons, Delaney Walker, Travis Kelce. Zach Ertz is probably right on the fence because I still think he struggles to stay healthy. But you got Jimmy Graham, Tyler Eifert, Martellus Bennett, and then probably like – and Jordan Reed, obviously. And then after that, I'd say I'd kind of put Kyle Rudolph in that next category right below all those names that I kind of just mentioned that he could kind of mix in. It doesn't have to be an exact number, but he's kind of right in that same range.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how about you, Prince?
Yeah, I think I would agree. I think I have Kyle Rudolph probably 10th, maybe 11th tight end. He does – you know, he does have the ability to be, you know, a number one tight end, so I don't want to take away from that. It's just that, you know, it's kind of like we keep saying, we don't have this level of let's game plan for Kyle Rudolph to be stopped, and then you stop the Vikings offense. I mean, we've seen enough times where Kyle Rudolph hasn't had the greatest game, and it really hasn't had no impact on – not no impact, but not as much of an impact on the game as it should. I do want to see some games where, you know, the mentality is let's take away Kyle Rudolph or let's take away that number one tight end. And that actually does affect the game, you know. And I think you see that with some other teams. You know, you take away Jordan Reed. Yeah, Washington had a lot of weapons, but you did obviously see some inconsistencies with their offense. You know, you take away a Rob Gronkowski, you know, there is a level of – there is a little bit of a drop off as far as the Patriots offense, even though they still perform at a very high level.
Take away Greg Olsen in that offense. Well, at least in the last few years.
Last year.
And that offense was nothing besides Cam running the ball.
Exactly. So, I mean, and I think that's the biggest thing that when I look at Kyle Rudolph is I want him to have a more profound impact so that, you know, if we're losing games, you know, you can be like, yeah, they took away Kyle Rudolph, and, you know, that did stunt our offense because he's that good. You know, we want to get him the ball. We want to feed him the ball versus, you know, he kind of complements the offense versus, like, being kind of an actual playmaker weapon.
Okay. So rapid fire, because you just said, you know, playmaker weapon. I'm just going to go one-word answer from each of you. Yinka, Kyle Rudolph, if you're starting a franchise right now, you taking Kyle Rudolph or Eric Ebron? Rapid fire, sir.
Yeah, rapid fire. I'll go Kyle Rudolph.
Okay, Miles?
Oof, that's the wrong answer. I'm sorry, bro. I'm going Eric Ebron.
Okay, JR, bring us home.
Rudolph.
Okay. And then we'll keep it with the rapid fire theme here. We're going to rank the NFC.
You didn't answer the question, Jason.
Oh, I'm probably going with Eric Ebron on that one. But I feel like you knew that already. Rapid fire part two. NFC North tight end groups. JR, rank them for us. Best to worst.
Obviously, Green Bay is number one. They have I hate that they got this guy, but Martellus Bennett is going to be an absolute stud in that offense. I would say Kyle Rudolph is two for the Vikings. I would say Detroit is three just because Ebron is a huge liability in the running game. He just can't be on the field in the running game because he's an awful blocker.
Do they run the ball in Detroit, though, ever?
They can't. And, I mean, who was the Bears tight end right now? I couldn't even name
exactly. Adam
Shaheen.
Did they get rid of Zach Miller?
The pride and joy of Ashland. Who? Did they get Zach Miller?
They get rid of him?
I don't know. Do they have Zach Miller?
They've had him. I don't know if he's still there.
Get it up right now. I guess the Bears, they just stay in last every time we do this, huh? So
they drafted Adam Shaheen, the pride and joy of Ashland.
So right now the Bears have Zach Miller, Deion Sims, and Adam Shaheen, 1, 2, and 3 on the depth chart. And a former Vikings training camp stud, Michael Pruitt buried down in there as well. But Zach Miller, Deion Sims, Adam Shaheen, I think the Bears can stay in last place. Okay, Miles, how about you?
Yeah, Green Bay, obviously. Got to be Martellus Bennett's the number one tight end in the NFC North. And I'd agree. I'd say Kyle Rudolph. Then, obviously, I think then Eric Ebron.
Hold up. But didn't you just take Eric Ebron?
I said right. Kyle Rudolph. No. You said if we're starting from scratch for the future, I'm talking right now, I would take Kyle Rudolph over Eric Ebron. I'm not talking for the future. If we're talking future long-term, I'm taking Eric Ebron over Kyle Rudolph.
Have you considered a career in politics, Miles?
Is that not a difference? In 2017, I would rather have Kyle Rudolph than Eric Ebron. In 2019, I'd probably have Eric Ebron over Kyle Rudolph if we're talking right now. But
okay.
But anyways.
Both Miles 2020.
No, I'm not old enough. I'm going Martellus Bennett, Kyle Rudolph, Eric Ebron, probably Lance Kendricks at that point. Might be the fourth best tight end in the NFC North. And then Zach Miller, Adam Shaheen, whatever his name is. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Nothing too exciting.
So I think Miles went Green Bay, Minnesota, Detroit, and then back to Green Bay again, and then to Chicago. So Chicago is the fifth worst tight end group in the NFC North.
Which
might actually be correct. Yeah. That might be the correct answer. Sexy Prince, how about you, man?
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with the Green Bay, the Minnesota, Detroit, then Chicago.
Wow. You got that out just in the nick of time, as is our custom as we start to wind down the pod. Yinka's internet service provider has started to throttle him once again.
It wouldn't be a pod if I wasn't randomly thrown off whatsoever. But welcome back, to bring it home. Thank you. To bring it home, yeah, Green Bay, Minnesota, Detroit, Chicago. I probably have to even put Chicago 6. Give Minnesota 2 tight ends and then put Chicago all the way at the very bottom.
David Morgan.
David Morgan, the pride and joy. great hope
for David Morgan, which is probably the strangest thing that I've ever seen when going to look at someone on Player Profiler. David Morgan, slow, but really agile somehow.
Very strange.
No. Jason Witten is bottom percentile, I think, most everything.
Was he?
Let's not go back and have that conversation.
I don't. That was like 15 years ago.
Yeah, you love the compilers. We understand, Treadwell.
David Morgan's going to have a long career because he can run block.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, run blockers have a place, but the NFL tells us which ones they value more when it's time to pass out those contracts. We can look at what, you know, a Jimmy Graham gets paid, who's never been what anyone would call a great run blocker. And we can look at what a Rhett Ellison, David Morgan, run blocking type gets paid. And I feel like that tells us which one the NFL values more.
I will say that what I like what Seattle's done is they've kind of made him learn to block because of their scheme and what they have to do. They've started to force him to have to learn to block. So he kind of had to do that. So I like that.
All right. What we got upcoming? Who's working on what? Yinka and JR, you guys, I feel like we have a East Coast, West Coast type of situation going on over here where one of you throws out an article, the next one immediately fires back with some fire. You know, we got the battle going on here. So, JR, what's the next blow that's going to be sent out in this battle here? What you got coming up for us?
Training camp coverage starts tomorrow on climbingthepocket.com, going over the quarterbacks and just giving an overview and just the outlook on everyone on the roster, and it will continue throughout the week and then the next week as well for every position.
Can I ask you preemptively, why do you hate Sam Bradford?
I do not hate Sam Bradford. I don't trust Sam Bradford.
Okay, so I'm going to need you to go ahead and copy-paste that right now and just get ready to respond to all tweets with that for probably the next 48 hours or so.
I welcome them all.
All right, then. Saxy Prince, what you got going on, my man?
Yes, sir. You know, I had to take a break from the depth chart series. I was actually writing the cornerback depth chart, and then again we got into this NFL verbiage conversation, and just, you know, that inspiration hit me. Had to get it out. Had to like put my thoughts on paper, so to speak. So yeah, I'll probably hop back into the depth chart for either tomorrow or Wednesday. And then I'll finish it up. And that should probably lead us all to training camp, hopefully. And then I'll have a lot of training camp covers that I'll be doing. So
nice. And Miles, have you got everything ready, everything prepared that you need to have done? Is your suit ready? Is the liquor ordered? Are you ready to go, my man?
As ready as I'm going to be, yeah.
Have you figured out what day you need to be at the church?
It's not at a church, thank God. That was my one rule, no church. So
okay.
Yes, I'll be there. Everything's all set. This will be my last pod for the next 2 weeks.
All right. Well, I guess we better get this fantasy draft we got going on Wednesday done with a quickness, or I'll be picking the back half of your team for you.
You might have to pick all of it, but you go ahead. Yeah.
All right, as for myself, no articles at the top of mind right now, but I do have a fantasy football trade calculator I built last year that I'm going to put some tweaks on and try to get up on the site at some point here in the next week or so, if I can find the time to get that all done. But that is it for this episode.
When I get back to – hold it real quick. When I get back, I'm going to get back into writing some articles too. So,
I don't know, but
I will.
Since Miles just put that out there, we're going to go ahead and put a bet out right now. Who we get an article from on the site first? Will it be Miles after his honeymoon or just Yinka, period?
Miles is too busy writing his wedding vows right now. That's what he's doing.
You are not wrong.
I'm not right.
Yeah, I'm just saying. So, JR, where are you going? I still got my vote with Miles on this one.
I'm gonna go with Miles too. I think the comment section kind of motivates Yinka.
Yeah, man. You can go out there.
I try to stay away from the comment section though. I'll go into it like, you know, like, hey, what's going on here? Oh, 12 new comments, and then it'll be like, F you, Yinka, and I'm like, okay, well.
Yeah, they mad at you, man.
That giant X button. Oh, they mad.
Yeah, they mad at you. All right. Well, thank you for tuning in for another episode of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. Yeah, nothing profound to say. Talk to you guys soon.